Welcome to the first and beta episode of Football America. And this is Greg James of From the 55 Yard Line podcast and also Gridiron Japan podcast. And I'm sitting here today, I am in Japan, and I'm sitting here today with Aaron Harris of the Football Odyssey podcast. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing good, man. Congratulations on the new show, and thank you for choosing me as your inaugural guest.
I, you know, you were my first choice. That's, you know, I mean, when it comes to talking about, you know, it's one thing to talk about the games themselves and the X's and O's, but there's so much more to football and really much more to football and more to sports than just what happens on the field. And that's what I kind of wanted this show to be about, to talk about kind of the outside forces that affect the games that we watch, that we love, whether it be basketball, baseball, obviously football, soccer, and even hockey. So, but when it comes to, you know, this show, it's about football, but we'll incorporate other elements of other sports in there as we go along in the conversation, obviously. And yeah, so we are, this is the first episode, and we're going to sit down. The Super Bowl just ended yesterday. And what, you know, I mean, it was a great game, but there was so much to it beforehand. So, I mean, I'm sitting there as I'm watching the pregame hype, and the inner 14-year-old, inner 12-year-old in me goes, man, it was so much different back in the 70s. So, yeah, let's talk about the Super Bowl. Let's talk about yesterday. What are your thoughts? Obviously, it was a good game, but did you watch all the Super Bowl hype before all that?
I did not watch a single minute, and I'm actually proud to say it at this point because it's become a little, it's just overkill. And frankly, I was actually down in South Florida, and I was driving back up, so I was getting the car for about 2.5 to 3 hours commuting, so I wouldn't have had a chance to watch it anyway, but by the time I got back to my apartment, no, I didn't feel the need to watch any pregame. I turned it on at 6:30, and then 10 minutes later, they kicked off. I used to really enjoy the pregame aspect of it, but now it just seems that there's far too much coverage leading up to it, and there's only so many topics that you can dive into, so many feature stories you can tell. And frankly, even throughout the week, I didn't really listen to too many podcasts or radio shows previewing the game because after, you know, the first week, what more can you really say?
You just basically
get a lot of people that are getting on there to, you know, promote their sponsors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I, being over here in Japan, I'm kind of insulated from at least the live stuff. I don't have cable anymore. I don't have satellite. You know, I can pick and choose what I want. So when it comes to how much I get over here, I can be very selective. So for me, you know, my day usually starts off, turning on Dan Patrick, the podcast, and then Rich Eisen, and then I'm done. And so I only really, it's basically, I have a little bit of an echo chamber, I guess, but yeah, it goes to what you said. I mean, it, you know, everybody, at least on those shows, was just everybody, every player, what's his name from, quarterback for Jacksonville.
Trevor Lawrence.
He was on there promoting a product. So everybody was promoting something. But what I was missing was, what I was hoping for was, you know, say somebody from NFL Films, somebody to talk more about the history. You know, Greg Cosell would have been a perfect guest for the week at the Super Bowl. And he's been on before, but to talk not only about NFL Films, but also his uncle too. I always, anytime Greg Cosell goes on a show, I'm like, oh, there's going to be Howard Cosell talk at some point. Yeah. I'm right there with you. I watched about 2 hours of it because in Japan, Super Bowl came on at 8:30 in the morning Monday. So I made sure I got up at 6:30 in the morning, turned on. That was about the time with the NFL International Game Pass. That's when the coverage starts. So I watched that, and believe me, you missed absolutely nothing. There wasn't even a retrospective of about, you know, there was a Pat Tillman thing that they always cram in
right
when there's a Super Bowl down in Arizona. And also too, the veteran in me, I still get very pissed off with the NFL and their salute to service crap, because I know it's, you know, I think a lot of people there are genuine with their feelings and want to honor, but it's become so commercial that it's lost on me. At least I missed the USAA commercials with Gronk. I didn't see any of those this year.
Yeah, the commercials this year, in my opinion, were really not anything noteworthy. The only one that I really enjoyed was the Busch Light commercial where they were mimicking those abused animal shelters commercials, and you had like the werewolf, the bear. I don't know if you had a chance to see that one. That to me was a humorous one. But aside from that, there was nothing that I noticed that was really stuck out to me.
What stuck out to me was I didn't pay attention. I guess maybe did I? Yeah, I mean, it just like you said, it was so unmemorable. I'm like, okay, I don't really remember. The ones that really got me that I watched and I walked away going, really, what the hell is going on? Were the Caddyshack ones? Mm-hmm. They tried to parrot. It was a parody of Caddyshack, and that just fell absolutely flat.
It did feel like a lot of these commercials were like targeting, people who were teenagers 20 or 30 years ago. It's like you had a new Indiana Jones movie coming out that they were promoting.
Right.
Fast and Furious 10 or whatever they're on. That was a big draw. They had another one with, I don't remember the context of the commercial, but it was P. Diddy producing in the studio and a bunch of 90s artists sucked. Coming on and, doing a parody of the song that they became famous for. It was like, it felt like nostalgia was a big theme of this slate of commercials, but it just didn't really land anywhere for me personally.
Yeah, it sucked. Those really fell flat. And then there was one too. It was about, talking about movie trailers.
Mm-hmm.
You saw the one for The Flash. I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to see that when that comes out. Because, I don't know how big of a comic book fan you are, or comic book movies, but I'm a huge DC guy, and obviously they're about ready to reset that whole universe anyway. And I'm like, oh, maybe this might be the way to reset everything and get that whole franchise on track. Cause it looked like a really good trailer. And did you see it? I don't want to spoil
I'm not going to see the movie, but, this shows you how little I know about comic books. I used to enjoy the movies at one point, but I think after about like 2014 or 15, I just stopped watching them. I looked to my buddy to my right who enjoys those movies more or less. Yeah. And I asked him, what is being super fast as a superpower really going to do for you as a superhero? I mean, he told me that he can run, so fast that he rips through the time portal. He can time travel. I'm like, that's all well and good, but really, what's his major power? It's like Superman has super strength. The Green Lantern, manifest energy. I didn't really see what the Flash's superpower was aside from being really fast. But he explained to me that he can move so fast that he can create a tornado if he runs in a circle or if he runs at you really fast. He's like a ton of bricks, so. I guess that made sense to me after that, but I was kind of like, it feels like a superpower you'd want to have if you want to run away from conflict.
Right. Well, the trailer for that movie, the Flash trailer, Michael Keaton's in the movie.
Okay.
And he's playing Batman now, 35? I don't know. A long way from when he played in 89. But there in the trailer, you got the Flash going, and Michael Keaton repeats the line from the first movie, I'm Batman. I'm like, ooh, this might actually be good. So we'll see. DC, which is kind of going to roll into my next subject here as we're talking about football. But DC, as we know, has kind of fallen flat with.
But before we get to that, can I just talk about the game real quick?
Yeah, no. I was just going to say they've fallen flat with Black Adam, but that's. We'll talk about that in a bit, but let's talk about the game. And
I just realized I never gave you my thoughts on the game. So I did think it was an entertaining game. It to me was very reminiscent of the Patriots Eagles Super Bowl from 2017. One of those situations where the offense just moved the ball at will. And it did feel like, there was basically three plays that came down to deciding the difference. Obviously, Jalen Hurts' fumble, giving a tie to the Chiefs. And then what was the, I can't remember his name, the punt return that set up the last Chiefs touchdown.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, the Chiefs. And, yeah. And then obviously that penalty that essentially iced the game in Kansas City's favor. But I did think it was an entertaining game. I'm not going to go so far as to say that it was, you know, one of the best Super Bowls I've ever seen or that it was epic. I think the fact that we didn't have that dramatic ending with, you know, Jalen Hurts trying to drive the team down the field in the last 90 seconds to at least tie it, but possibly even win it, kind of ruined it. And not only that, but like I'm someone who typically I would much prefer to see a 28-24 game. Yeah, and then something where both teams are, you know, getting up in the 30s, because I do enjoy when defenses are able to make some, you know, a few big plays throughout the game. And I think it adds a little bit to the drama when you don't really suspect or know for certain that the teams are going to be able to move the ball up and down the field at will. You know, it's like, right. I think the possessions kind of are a little more valuable when you're going up against a defense that can, you know, turn the ball over, at least, you know, force a few three and outs in a row or a few punts in a row. And I kind of feel like that drama was a little absent just because of that fact.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there were some, obviously there were some good, great defensive plays and turnovers that led to scores that, you know, obviously could have, it was very much an even game between both teams. Either 100%. Team could have won, but it boiled down to who had the ball at the end. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you put the ball in Mahomes' hands towards the end of the game, it's kind of like that, you know, that, way back when, and you're too young to remember this, but anytime Joe Montana had the ball last, like, oh yeah, we left too much time on the clock. And of course, right. Montana, as Montana always did, even back when he played for Notre Dame. That just shows you how old I am.
I've seen that Cotton Bowl game actually against Houston. Yeah. It was pretty improbable what he did. And yeah, I think that's obviously the, you know, the benchmark for what a legendary quarterback is, you know, when the time is right for you to come and give your team a victory, whether you're from behind or whether the game's tied, and you're automatic. Right. And Mahomes was automatic. I mean, I think I saw the stat that he only had one incompletion in the second half, and he didn't have his numbers weren't gaudy by any means, but
they didn't need to be. And you know what? I'm not a Chiefs fan. In fact, I despise, you know, the Chiefs, and but their fan base is the third most annoying fan base in the NFL. Packers and Cowboys are 1 and 2. And as somebody who grew up in Chicago, you know, obviously anytime the Packers lose, we believe that an angel gets its wings.
There's quite a few angels this year.
But I had Mahomes on my fantasy football team, my office fantasy football team, and I had AJ Brown with the Eagles. So I cruise to an office victory this year, right? You know, right after I retired. So, I mean, I know that Mahomes, you give Mahomes the ball, magic's just going to happen. And which, you know, I mean, it's a whole nother, you know, Chicago Bear fans still go nuts because the Bears could have had Mahomes.
Yeah, that's right. They do they draft Fields instead of
They traded Mahomes up and to Fields, and then Mahomes went after. It's like, you know.
And I think he's just another example of I guess in some ways how the difference in the college game, the program has diminished so much because, you know, coming from that Texas Tech air raid style of offense, you know, people, you know, question, you know, you may be putting up 500 yards a game passing the ball 400 yards, but can you really play our style of football and do it, you know, the way that we have typically done it for however many years now? Right. And, you know, he came in against the Chargers, I think, the last game of 2017, whenever their Alex Smith was sat down for, you know, just so he didn't get injured when they had a playoff game the next week, and he just tore it up. And I mean, I can remember being in Atlanta whenever I first moved there. I went to the Steeler bar that I ended up going to for a few years. It was my second time there. And Mahomes comes in and throws like 6 touchdowns, and people, like, you know, thought, you know, he's going up against the Steeler defense. They always do well against, you know, young players, and he just absolutely carved them apart. And watching that, I was like, man, this guy really is a sensational story so far.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to see that, but when you're playing against them, you're like, oh yeah.
You know, the story is pretty much written.
But when Mahomes started coming, remember that ankle tackle And he was limping off like, ooh, I mean.
I thought the Super Bowl was ruined at that point.
I did too. I'm like, oh, but you know, then the flip side is you got Jalen Hurts, which is he's a hell of a story.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And so I can remember, I remember whenever he was in college being benched in the national championship game. I remember watching that, seeing him on the sideline with his helmet. And then they had made the announcement. I don't know who the sideline reporter was, but she had said that, they were going with Tua, and I was like, you know, did he get hurt or not? And it didn't seem like it. You know, he still had his helmet on. I guess just what's his name, Saban, thought that Tua had something to move the ball and against Georgia. And yeah, that's something that can really, you know, knock a guy off course, right? You know, psychologically, you're like, you just got benched in front of however many million people that were watching the game. You really didn't do anything to lose your job. You know, Alabama was undefeated that year. He was having, you know, a pretty decent season from what I remember, but, you know, he persevered. And then, you know, now, you know, he's proven that he can compete with anybody in the league.
Yeah. Yeah. He's one of the elite quarterbacks. I mean, he had the best record I think the Chiefs had who had the best record at the end of the season? Was it the Chiefs or the Eagles?
They were tied. I think they both finished 14 wins and 3 losses in the regular season.
Yeah. So you lead a team to the best record in the one of the best records in the NFL. You make it to the Super Bowl, and the loss is not. I mean, he didn't do anything to lose that game. They just ran out of time.
Right.
I mean, he's. You know, I'm hoping to see him back. I mean, next year's fantasy football draft, he'll go number one or two. I'm pretty sure.
Oh yeah, easily. And yeah, it's kind of like the analogy to the Super Bowl that the Eagles won a few years ago. Yeah, it's like when you have these offensive shootouts, more or less, it comes down to, you know, just one or two plays on defense or on special teams that, you know, kind of make up the difference. And that was exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah. But it was a good game. But it was a good game. I mean, it wasn't. I grew up in a time when most Super Bowls were blowouts. So I mean, you know, nowadays.
Yeah, I was explaining that to my roommate last night, where there was a few years where it just wasn't really enjoyable to watch. You just had the Broncos getting blown out a couple times, the Bills, the Chargers.
Starting with the first Super Bowl I saw, which was Super Bowl 11, I mean, the Oakland Raiders blew out the Vikings. The next year, the Cowboys blew out the Broncos.
Mm.
You know, Super Bowl 13 to me is still the best Super Bowl ever. But then again, that was a 35-31 game. Mm-hmm. And I was 12 years old at the time. And for many years, that was the best Super Bowl out there. Just how bad the other Super Bowls were. And then till you got to Super Bowl 25, and that's when things started to turn around, but it was slow. But yeah, nowadays, at least the Super Bowl, we go into it thinking, well, this should be a competitive game. But yeah, years and years before, it was a snore.
Yeah, I think the only real blowout I've seen in my lifetime was when Seattle destroyed Manning and the Broncos.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty unbearable to watch. And
well, in that game when that snap went bad over Manning's head, that's the game right there. This is not going to go well. And it sure as shit, it did not go well for the Broncos.
Yeah, and it was a shame too, because, you know, you have one team that was, you know, the Legion of Boom. It was, you know, regarded as, you know, the best new defense in the league, and went on eventually become sort of like the defense of the decade. And then you had this record-setting offense.
Yeah,
I think that was when Manning threw like 55 touchdowns to break Brady's 50 touchdown record, and he sat one game too, which was pretty remarkable. But that didn't really kind of come to fruition the way that we had all hoped to see the best, you know, one of the best offenses in history versus, you know, a defense that had come into its own.
Yeah, yeah, and then, you know, fortunately, a few years later, we got the flip side with the Broncos. Their defense comes in and just was unstoppable in Super Bowl 50 playing against Cam, and the Broncos defense just completely grounded the Panthers. And, you know, you had Peyton Manning just kind of playing. I mean, all he had to do was manage the game, just not make any mistakes. And, you know, that was, you know, so, but yeah, no, this, yeah. And it'll be interesting to see, how things progress. I mean, where's the Super Bowl being played at next year? Do you know off the top of your head?
Vegas.
Okay.
which I'm sure Pete Rozelle is rolling around in his grave right now.
Oh man, that's, well, and you know, that kind of goes into probably what want to talk about, just kind of where the football is heading to. And you know, gambling obviously is a huge factor in with sports nowadays. But it is funny, now that I'm thinking about it, talking about Vegas, this year, I mean, the ads were out there for FanDuel and all the gambling, you know, but not as much as in years past. Did you notice that at all?
The only FanDuel commercial that I remember seeing was the Gronk.
Okay.
Which I didn't really follow what that was leading up into it. So to me, it just looked like shit from the beginning. But I guess now that you mentioned it, didn't see too many commercials. I mean, there was DraftKings and what was the other one?
FanDuel.
Yeah. I think I saw one of each, but
I didn't see any Caesars commercials, which actually are kind of my favorite anyway, because it's got the Mannings and it's got JB Smoove. But yeah, no, we've got, I mean, we're in an era nowadays where, like you said, Pete Rozelle has got to be rolling over his grave with the way gambling is so infiltrated, not just football, but sports in general. Mm-hmm. Now that, I mean, and they were talking, who was I listening to? They were talking, I think it was maybe Dan Patrick I was listening to the other day. And they were talking about, well, how do you keep games from being fixed now? Well, obviously, these guys get paid so much money, they don't need to. The temptation for these guys, I don't think there's any temptation because they're making so much money just to play the game itself. I mean, but yeah, no, it's, you know, I don't know actually where I'm going with this, but
well,
it's funny, the gambling aspect is just, it still blows my mind after all these years.
Well, it's funny you bring that up because recently I've been, flipping through Dan Moldea's book, Interference, about how organized crime infiltrates professional football. And the book was written, published back in the late 80s. So, you know, in a lot of ways it's dated.
Right.
And it may not hold up as well, but it is interesting in some of the things that you look at that could still be a factor, right? Like obviously, you know, a bookmaker would have a hard time convincing a guy to throw a game, you know, through bribery because you're not going to match his salary, you know?
Right.
Maybe someone in college, I suspect it would be possible, but even then I'm not sure that you could really get away with it just because of how, you know, much security is probably around those kids from, especially the bigger schools, in which I'm sure, you know, they have like, you know, security personnel to watch these kids and make sure that they're not, you know, getting in trouble in the community or something. But, you know, one aspect that he did bring up when he interviewed, I think it was Warren Welsh, who was one of the former NFL security directors, that, you know, if a guy like has a history of drugs, right, and, you know, all of a sudden he gets into a little bit of a bad habit, all a guy has to do if he's in debt to his drug dealer, say, hey, you know, you shave some points and your debt is wiped clean. So I guess in some ways it would have to be more through, extortion means if you're going to get someone to fix the game. But yeah, just through straight bribery, I'm not sure it's possible anymore.
Right. And then there's also the other added thing too, which we didn't even talk about, but we live in a day and age where everything is recorded. Everything's out in the open.
Oh yeah.
I mean, we all walk around literally with things in our pockets that make us, we can report live from anywhere in the world and take pictures that the quality of is way better than anything anybody could have dreamed about back in the 20th century. So, we got Vegas next year, but yeah, the whole gambling, I mean, do you see, I mean, and you're much younger than me. So, I mean, do you foresee in the future even more gambling, do you think we reach a saturation point where, you know,
as long as it makes the NFL a profit, then yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think it's just one of those situations. Like I personally don't bet on sports. I mean, for me, if I bet, it's like, I'll go to a casino and play blackjack, or if I'm playing pool,
right,
or I'll put, you know, 20 bucks on a game or something like that. But you know, I personally don't bet on anything that I can't really have some sort of direct involvement in.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was explaining this to my wife the other day. I don't understand why anybody would throw money away.
Yeah. I mean, well, because the reward you could get, right? I mean, it's like, yeah, you could take a loss, but you could also double your money, you know? So it's like, you know, for the NFL, if it continues to make them a profit and, you know, drives people, then yeah, absolutely. It's going to continue to increase. You know, will there ever be a tipping point? Probably not. I mean, I think that obviously with how fantasy is going and prop bets and parlays, I think there's a lot of intrigue for people who aren't even sports fan, which that's something I think that has really kind of defined Roger Goodell's career, is how he's been able to increase the sports appeal to non-football fans. You know, I mean, people, I know people who, you know, will watch maybe, you know, some game on Sunday, you know, but they're not going out of their way to watch it the same way I would, but they have a fantasy team and they keep up with it and they set their lineup every week, even if they watch the game or not. And it's the same thing, I guess, with sports betting too. It's like, you may not have any rooting interest in either one of these teams or know who any of the players are, but you'll just look at the numbers of who's doing what and you'll place a bet. So I think as long as it continues to bring in, you know, non-fans to the game, absolutely, it's going to get even bigger.
Yeah. And, you know, with the sport itself. So, you know, we've got, now that the Super Bowl is over, but we definitely got more football coming up this, the rest of this year. So we're entering into, I mean, this coming Sunday, the XFL kicks off. What are your thoughts? Do you think, I mean, this is the XFL, this is obviously version 3.0, but what do you think? I mean, I don't know. I'm just going to, I'll let you tell me what you think, and I'll tell you what I think in terms of where I think spring football is going. And just from my experiences as a kid watching the other leagues growing up.
Well, Orlando, where I live, is actually getting a team. So I'm going to follow them and actually go to some of the games and see Orlando Guardians. Aside from that, I'm not really sure. I think there's 8 teams total.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess it's hard to be, you know, overly optimistic that it's going to perform well. You know, obviously, you know, back in 2001, that collapsed for a multitude of reasons. And yeah, that was also a much different point in American culture where, you know, we didn't have any streaming. The internet didn't really play that big of a factor in people's entertainment value. You know, it's still just more of a utensil than it was, you know, a lifestyle brand or choice, I guess you could say. Right. So you didn't really have to worry about streaming. You had cable, obviously, that, you know, would maybe add some competition, but, you know, the 3 networks reign supreme still. And, you know, they tried something out whenever they thought they could maybe find a new audience. And, you know, again, there's a lot that went into it that kind of led to that collapse. But, you know, 20 years later, they try it again in a more saturated media environment. So,
yeah,
I guess there's maybe you're never going to get a totally huge fan base like maybe you would have, you know, a few years ago when you tried to experiment with it. But
I'm trying to think. Did you interview the author of The Long Bomb on your show?
Yeah, Brett Forrest. Yeah,
that's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which go ahead. I didn't mean I just wanted to interject that in there. That's a great interview you did with him.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, he was interesting to talk to just because of how long ago the book was written. I mean, I think the book was published in 2002 and I spoke to him 20 years later, and given how, you know, the drive is still there to try to find some sort of alternative football league, I thought was a relevant conversation. And I haven't spoken to him since I did that interview, but I know he said that they were looking to do an audiobook version and release a paperback version of the book by the time this new league comes out. So I wonder if there's any update on that, but I think, you know, in that conversation, it just highlights that people will go for football as long as it's good football, you know, and I don't really recall watching too much of the XFL in the right before COVID. I paid a little more attention to the AAF because there was an Atlanta team and that I went to a couple of their games. So for me, I paid a little more attention, but just seeing how, you know, both of those leagues ended up collapsing, you know, like I said, it's hard to have any sense of optimism, but you know, I mean, the USFL is back for, you know, round 2, which I, you know, was kind of skeptical if that was actually going to happen. So, you know, maybe, and from what I understand, the USFL is not even kicking off until like April or something like that.
So their seasons don't even overlap.
Maybe people will have a natural intrigue. You know, I suspect that maybe the first couple weeks, or maybe, you know, the couple weeks following week 1 are going to suffer a little bit just because I think there is a little bit of football fatigue, but if the product is good enough, maybe people will tune in, but that is a big if.
And I'm very critical. Anybody who knows, follows me on social media knows I'm very critical, especially the XFL and the Rock and all the faith put in. When I ask people, and I do apologize on your end, can you hear the construction going on my end?
No.
Okay, good. Because I have a whole ton of construction. So thank God software is able to filter all the noise, the jackhammers in the back out. But going back to what I said, you know, on social media, you know, I'm very critical of the XFL, not so much of the USFL, because I kind of get how the USFL is trying to market their league by, okay, we're going to test this out in front of a TV audience and go from there. Mm-hmm. Whereas the XFL, it's like, boom. I mean, to me, it's like, okay, we're going to be like the old AFL. We're going to start in cities where they don't have to, and this is what we're going to do. And so, you know, you had several examples of leagues that have failed just in the recent past. You had the AAF, which failed spectacularly. Obviously you had the XFL.
Mm.
And also too, the Arena Football League went away. I mean, you've had all these other leagues, these spring leagues kind of either fizzle away, flop. But the one thing that you kind of touched upon it, when it came to the football was actually pretty good. AAF football was good. The XFL 2.0 was good, but it didn't stick around long enough. You know, obviously the pandemic, you know, forced it to close. But then you had the XFL back in 2001, and the football in that just completely sucked. I mean, it was like watching practice squads. It was just horrible football. But there was a lot of things they actually got right too with Vince McMahon and how he. I mean, we have Skycam because of the XFL, the original.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of innovations that, you know, were drawn from it. Like I never watched that Ebersol documentary about this was the XFL.
It's really good. It's definitely worth your time, man.
Yeah. I'll definitely, it's definitely been on my list for a while. But yeah, to your point, I mean, to be honest, most of the games I did watch from that season, because before Brett came on the show, I wanted to go back and watch those games to kind of put myself in that mindset. But most of the games I did watch were either the LA Extreme or the Las Vegas Outlaws, because Brett had followed that team specifically throughout the season. But something that you think is interesting is that you said the Arena Football League last, like it was something that people had forgotten about. I don't think it's any coincidence that league had actually stood the test of time for however many years. And I've said this before, and obviously we have a lot of crossover in our audience, so I apologize if people are hearing me say this again, but when I watch another football league, I don't want to watch a carbon copy of the NFL. You know, if the product is really that good, fine. But truthfully, if the product was going to be that good, they'd be playing in the NFL, right? For me, if you really want to get my attention, I'll watch, you know, a league that has bizarre rule changes, you know, multiple men in motion. You can only, you know, you can have unlimited forward passes behind the line. Anybody behind the line of scrimmage can catch a pass. I'll watch that all day. And I don't care if I'm the only one who's watching it. You know, I think a reason why something like, you know, the Arena League did well is because we know this isn't, you know, NFL football, but that's what makes it quirky and unique.
And going back to what I said about the Arena Football League, they were around for a long time, but their business model, but those teams came and went. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, it kind of felt, even though the league was around for a long time, it always felt like every year it was a new league because you just had different teams coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
There was no stability with the franchises other than, say, with the Arizona Rattlers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Arizona Rattlers and the Tampa Bay Storm were around for a long time. Orlando Predators were around for a long time, but no real stability. None of the teams that when the league finally did fold, none of those leagues were any of the original teams. So to me, it just kind of like, it felt like the AFL kind of felt like when I was in Iraq, somebody said, well, we've been here in Iraq 7 years. And somebody said, what I worked on when I was, intelligence advisor, army officer made the comment, no, we've been here 1 year for 7 years. So you had turnover every year. So to me, while the AFL was around, the Arena Football League was around many years, it just each year it just felt like a different league because so many teams came and went. But going back to what you were saying, but with these leagues though, I mean, the product on the field, especially let's talk about the product that was on the field in the last, say, 10 years. Good product on the field, AAF, the XFL. Last year, the USFL had good product. But to me, where it's always come down to, it's on the business end of these leagues that they completely fall flat. And going back to what you said about the original XFL, that business, that just, everybody got paid, but Vince McMahon pulled the plug because it wasn't going to make him any money.
Well, it seems to me that the original XFL was more of a marketing problem than it was a financial problem. Right. Well, it eventually translated into being a financial problem, but people just didn't know what they were exactly tuning in for. You know, were they tuning in to watch serious football? Were they turning in to watch, you know, a football version of WWE? No one really knew exactly like how to quite market it. You know, when you get Jesse Ventura ready to fight the Chicago coach on the field after they lost, you know, you're kind of looking at it. You're like, is this stage? Is it serious? Like no one really knew. And I think for a lot of the players and the coaches, they wanted, you know, football the way they had always known it in the NFL or in college. And then all of a sudden when they get all these cameras really intrusive in people's faces and player introductions and the showmanship of it and, you know, the sex appeal of it all, you know, I think there was, you know, a clear divide between what the, you know, what NBC wanted, what McMahon wanted. And I think in many cases, NBC and, you know, McMahon didn't really understand each other, what each other wanted for the product. And I think that there was never a coherent, you know, definition or vision for what the league should be. And ultimately, they didn't really know how to market it. And people said, well, you know, this is all well and good, but the product isn't even that good for me to stick long enough to figure this out. So they just abandoned it.
Yeah, his book.
And the fact that they continue to play their games on Sunday, on Saturday night too, which is like the least view, is the worst night for television,
right?
For viewership, that was not a good decision either.
Yeah, and I think these new leagues have taken those lessons and learned. But the AAF, obviously, you know, they learned a lot of lessons, but they just ran out of money.
Yeah.
You know, Charlie, and you would think of all the people that would fail at this, how could Charlie Ebersol have failed at the AAF? That's a book that I'm waiting to read on the AAF. There is a documentary on it, if you've seen it.
No, I heard the interview Tim Hanlon did with the director. I don't remember the name of it though.
Yeah, Tim did a great job. I mean, that was a great interview, but just, I would love to read a book that gets in the nitty gritty. Much like, you know, Mark Speck's books about, you know, the World Football League, get into the WFL. And, you know, there's, like you said, there's a great, you know, the long bomb. I mean, that gets into so much detail, and you walk away from that book going, okay, yeah, now it makes sense. And even with Vince McMahon trying to buy his way into the CFL.
Oh, that's happening again?
No, but that was back then. In that book. That's kind of how that started. I think the XFL, that's how the XFL came to being when, you know, they wouldn't, you know, he
couldn't get into the NFL or the CFL.
Right.
Well, what was it? What was his, I don't think he was just trying to get a team. Wasn't he trying to buy the league outright?
He wanted to buy the whole league. He said, well, how about the league? I think if I remember correctly, it started with the Argos, but then he's like, well, I'll buy the whole league. And, you know, the CFL governor said, you know, go pound sand. You're not buying our team. You're not going to buy our teams.
Right.
So,
Well, that's the consistent thread through all these stories, right? It's about the rejects that, you know, maybe don't have quite enough money, or they just can't break into the big leagues with, you know, the NFL for some reason. So they try to set out on their own. Right. I guess, you know, obviously going back to the arena, Jim Forrest was probably the exception to the rule, because, you know, he was more, you know, someone who came up in the NFL, you know, corporate side than he was,
right,
you know, as an owner. But I think it's, when it comes to like a book about the AAF, though, I don't know if there's too much there that you can really go into, because they never even finished a full season. I mean, from what I remember, they only got halfway. Is that correct? Do you remember?
They got, I think, up until like week 8 or maybe week 7.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I mean, or in fact, you know, talking about Orlando, I mean, that the team in Orlando was, I think, ultimately determined to have won the championship, because I think Steve Spurrier went out and bought everybody rinks or something.
I think that was they had a team in Tampa, I think.
No, they had, it was the Orlando Apollos.
That's right. Okay. So the XFL was had Tampa, right?
Yeah, which that team name is now out in Vegas.
The Vipers. Which,
Yeah, which they're going to be playing. And this gets into my, you know, I'm just curious to see what the first week one of the XFL looks like, because last I heard, I think the Vipers are playing at the minor league ballpark, which, mm-hmm. you know, hey, I'm all for, I love what the aesthetics of football and baseball parks, but when, you know, you're starting off playing in a baseball park and a major metropolitan area in a minor league ballpark, that's just not a good, I'm just curious how that's going to look on camera. So, and how fans are going to take to it, going, okay, are we going to watch minor league football? I mean, people go out, nobody puts minor league baseball down. So I don't understand why anybody would put minor league football down, but you know, not in this country, cause I'm in Japan, but in the States, if it's not NFL, very few people are going to pay attention. If it's not NFL or college football, major college football, very few people are going to tune in.
Well, last night, one of the people who was over at our apartment had actually asked about, like, you guys down to go see some Guardian games. Oh. And, you know, he's someone who is, I don't think he has a team loyalty, but, you know, he loves fantasy. He loves, you know,
right.
watching the game just as, you know, just a third party viewer, I guess you could say.
Okay.
There's, you know, he pretty much looks out for his fantasy team, so to speak.
Okay.
And, you know, just enjoys watching the game, right? Well, he actually brought it up. So for me, I thought that was kind of surprising, because
okay.
you know, if anybody was going to bring that up, it would be me, because, you know, I'm just fascinated more so than he would be. But yeah, you know, I think the potential is there, you know, for something to come to fruition, if nothing else, just for the novelty and the spectacle of it. But
right.
Yeah, you know, that's only going to last you a few weeks. You know, even for me, you know, watching the I was actually at an Atlanta Hawks game whenever the I can't remember what the name of the Atlanta team was, the Legends, I think. For the AAF.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I was checking my phone throughout the Hawks game, you know, interested to see, you know, what was happening right. and everything like that. But then, you know, progressively you just start tuning in a little less and less.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I went to one game where they played at Georgia State Stadium. And even then, you just see kind of the crowd had just diminished from what it looked to me on television, you know, the
right.
first night watching it. So, yeah, there's definitely going to be some trial and error. And, you know, where the USFL really has that their strength is that they're owned by Fox. You know,
right.
they can afford, you know, they have people who are so in touch with the product because they own the product. So they know how to market it. They know how to have it as a good operations. And I think in a lot of ways they're looking at this like what it is. And it's a developmental league, you know mm-hmm. I mean? They, not only for the players, but also for the broadcasters, you know I mean? They have Drew Brees, I think, coming over from NBC to do some games. I mean, they have some of their own talent that are going to, you know, do some sideline reporting as sort of a stepping stone. So when they want to get to the NFL or if that ever happens, but I think there's a certain self-awareness with the USFL, and I didn't really watch too much of the league last year, but I think there is a self-awareness that if I had to guess right now without seeing the XFL or without seeing any XFL games so far, they probably have a little bit more of an advantage in the long run.